Welcome to the Business and Leadership Channel. My name is Michelle Boulay, and I'm so honored to be a sponsor here at this amazing conference because it's my passion to help you connect to your own inner leader and let that transform the businesses and relationships you create. I'm a life coach and healer and an internationally recognized award-winning dance artist. And dancing taught me to listen to my own inner voice and let that guide me to my success. A very common thing that happens for business owners, creatives, and leaders is that you're so close to your next goal or breakthrough and then you stop. Doubt kicks in, worry, procrastination, fear, overwhelm, which kill growth in your business and creative process. So I'm giving a talk here on Saturday, October 24th, where you'll learn tools so that you can show up with clarity and belief in yourself and your ideas, consistency to keep showing up, and the embodied and intellectual understanding to move you gracefully through the challenges you'll meet as you grow, as you go for your goals. If you can't make it live, pick up your phone now, go to Instagram or Facebook, find me, follow me, and DM me the word success, and I'll send you the free resource I'll be sharing at my presentation. It's also in the show notes. However, I do recommend you attend live here or at my main stage presentation to get the full scope of what I'll be sharing to help you realize your creative dreams. And now, please enjoy this next presentation.
And without further ado, let's get right into it. Over to you, Stuart.
Well, thank you very much, Ravi. I really appreciate, and I'm just so humbled to be on this amazing platform. I'm right here in Singapore. It is really sunny outside, so it's kind of like a different kind of a vibe compared with the very dreary, dreadful kind of experience that COVID has kind of swept over across the world. And I just want to mention a couple of things with regard to why this particular topic is so important. But first, let me just do a very quick recap in terms of what some of the things can be very useful to latch onto and to help you to understand this entire presentation. I struggled. I admit that it's not an easy thing to squeeze everything into a single hour. I'm just gonna do my very best to give you guys what I have accumulated over the last 46 years of my life. 21st October was recommended to me. Well, 21st October was recommended to me by Stephanie. I chose 21st because it's my birthday. And for those of you out there, I'd like to wish you guys a happy birthday as well. Well, sort of like a rebirthday, because whenever we die, there's a part of us that feels that we're worthless, helpless, or hopeless. And I think that's one of the key considerations. As leaders, we're literally going in there to attempt to resurrect the dead from inside out. And for many people, it can be a very daunting and shall I say, troublesome task. So while this is live, but we're not face-to-face, it gets a little bit troublesome, but I'm gonna attempt to hold the space for all of you guys. So if you happen to experience any one of these, and I can tell you, most leaders that I've been working with, I've worked with quite a number of different types of leaders, they experience this. They experience this themselves, which drives them crazy. It drives them mad when they see their employees kind of like shying away from facing up to it. It's almost as if they're looking at a mirror reflection of themselves. You know, so as a person who's worked in psychotherapy, I was trained in psychology. I'm a counseling psychologist. I also am a coach. I'm also a leadership consultant. I wear quite a number of different hats. But that in and of itself is probably a clue to some of you guys that is related to this particular topic for today. So how do we unchain ourselves from all this? Well, let's just start off by taking a little bit of a look into what has happened for me. So if you take a look at a couple of these photographs, you can see me speaking. I've got pretty large stages, some small stages, and they kind of like highlight different aspects of my life. The one right at the top is my acceptance of the Total Defense Award last year. I've won it two periods in a row. It lasts for about 3 years. And basically, I am a very strong advocate of national service in Singapore, right? So you can see me over here receiving the Singapore Armed Forces 3rd Division Best National Serviceman Award. So just to give you an idea, a division consists of close to 10 to 15,000 men and women. So to be able to be given this award, I mean, it was like almost like a big thrill. But there's a reason why that happened. This is my division commander back then, General Alfred Fox. Over here is the end result of me having learned something known as neuro-linguistic programming. Some of you may have heard of NLP before. And NLP, in as far as I'm concerned, saved my life multiple times. You know, when life comes crashing down, I look into myself to attempt to look for ways to survive. And I'll tell you a couple of stories in terms of how that really shaped my understanding of what shame looks like. So over here, I'm standing next to Dr. Richard Bandler, who's one of the co-founders of NLP. So how does a guy whom at the age of 13 years old is failing his examinations, I'm the guy who goes up to my mom and say, "Mom, here's my report card." She takes a look at it and she's wondering why this kid is so enthusiastic, having passed at 50.1%, 50.1%. And I said, "Mom, at least it's a pass." And then I, you know, skip away and go do something else. And she's horrified. She's like, "This boy has no shame." You know, it's like, shouldn't you just go out there and go stand in a corner or something like that? Now, my mom wasn't that evil. She did bring about a revelation for me, which was, look, you may not associate bad results with shame. That's a good thing. But you most certainly cannot associate that with showing up and being better than who you are. So I was shipped off. I got pretty good at studies because I was shipped off to a summer camp equivalent where people were learning about accelerated learning. And that's where I was introduced to neuro-linguistic programming. Literally transformed the way I think, because as an introvert, there's no reason I would have spent 27 years in the Okay, just got muted. Sorry about that. The host muted me for some reason. Okay, maybe I was going on too much. But you know, one of the funny things about becoming really good in studies is I could hide underneath that. My shame was hidden under all of these accolades. It was like, I've got all this validation right now. And truth be told, the moment I got myself into my first, I won't call it a bout of shame. It was more like a series of events that led me into feeling absolutely inadequate about myself. And I wanted to hide away from the world. It wasn't academics. Academics was where because I knew the tools, I could really get in there. I could score my, you know, straight A's and stuff like that. But what got me was when I was thrust into a position of leadership. Now, mind you, I hold the rank of major in the reserves, right? That's not by any standards a junior rank. And I'm only telling you this because I think I had to struggle a lot in order to gain a sense of that identity. Because when I was a student council president in my teens, in my late teens, people would walk out of the meetings because they felt I was not a legit leader. And truth be told, I felt exactly the same way. You know, I had people who are in my executive committee who'd stand up and say, "Stuart, why the hell should I listen to you?" And walk out and bring their team out, leaving like half the room. So deep down inside, there was this effervescent desire to want to just run away and just to hide. But I can tell you that that's absolutely counter to experience of shame. And if anything is to be embodied, is the human emotion is so, it's such a amazing creation. It's just a miraculous messenger of what's going on inside of yourself that if you were to ignore the message, would be a really big mistake. And I'll share with you why. So plenty of accolades, right? I mean, I even have two master's degrees, as if one isn't enough. I've got an MBA and I've got an organizational psychology master's degree from one of the best. You know, and it's interesting that after I stopped, I mean, the reason why I stopped was I applied for a PhD and I was rejected from my alma mater. And, you know, it's like, hang on, don't you guys accept people like me? And they went like, no response. And it took me some time to think about that because it was like academics had always given me a lifeline and going into a PhD program would have been a good addition, wouldn't it? I mean, it would have been nice to have another accolade, but it would have all been extremely empty. That's all I can say. Now, What I wanted to share in my hour with you is this. This downwards arrow is probably one of the best representations of most part of my life, if not the best representation of the things that have happened to me, not just in the past, but even more recently. You're talking about being betrayed by people, you know, stealing $600,000 from you, putting the wrong kinds of decisions into a business. And I'm supposed to be a businessman, business mentor, and an entrepreneur. I'm supposed to be somebody who is, you know, telling people, you know, you got to be motivated. And then when this thing hit the fan, I just collapsed. You know, I just felt like completely giving up. And it was just difficult to scrape myself off the floor because I felt like I was run over by a 4-ton truck. Now, when you feel this way, trust me, there is a lot going on that you need to unpack. But I have started to believe, because of all these things, 2020 was nothing more than a blip in my entire downward streak. I mean, I've had great opportunities to become a top student, Beta Gamma Sigma, get promoted into the senior command, amongst other things, you know, have a multi-million dollar business grown and sold. But those were just accolades. The true accolade does not happen without the individual recognizing that the guy standing in front of the mirror, the girl standing in front of the mirror, is the person who ultimately is responsible for the feelings that he or she is going through. Now, I'm not saying that when you feel shame, that you are the one that's responsible for the shame. Let's not go there. The truth is that shame does happen. I mean, you've got cyberbullying, you've got public humiliations that are far more vehement now that people can actually hide their identities. They can just put an avatar, right, and not show up. But that is precisely why we need to stand up to the occasion. My friends, one of the things that I've discovered is that anytime there's a downtrend, that is exactly where the learning happens. A mentor figure told me this before. He said, "Stuart, there is nothing great about being strong during good times, but it is the person who's strong in bad times, that's the person you want to look out for." So over the course of my four paths in leadership, and suddenly, this is what struck me. I was invited to deliver a training program. This was like 2011. I was invited to do a leadership training program because they took a look at my materials and said, "Wow, this is good stuff." And I was supposed to teach veterans in the armed forces, 25, 30 years of service or more in the armed forces. And here's this guy, right, who's, yeah, I've got some accolades, but, you know, I never really was involved in the armed forces in the first place. I was feeling inadequate. I was feeling that I hadn't been able to adjust my sense of shame towards not being a good leader in my teenage years. And here I am, coming full circle, having to confront that. And that was one of the biggest, senses of incongruence that I had, you know, stepping in front of all these guys. And the first thing I had to level with them was this: guys, you know, especially these guys were former drill sergeants. They were sergeant majors of the army, the school sergeant majors and so on. And they had their eyes fixed on me. I mean, it's like, you know, when I was in uniform, where were you? Right. And they, some of them did have that look, but fortunately for me, a number of them were open enough to listen to my story. And this is exactly the story that I had shared with you in brief. And you could not see that some of them could see themselves in me, that, you know, as a leader, sometimes people don't listen to you and you feel this sense of inadequacy, this shame, this worthlessness. You try and tell them something, you try and give them good stuff, and they maybe stab you in the back, whether it's your team members, colleagues, or even some employees. But one of the things that was absolutely sure, one of them, who was a very senior sergeant major, came up to me at the end of the story, and he said, "This is precisely the reason why you're here. It is because you're sharing with us, with courage, that story that happened to you. And all of us have gone through this, and that makes us trust you." And that was a huge revelation for me, because never in my life did I ever think that, okay, let's be vulnerable. Let's kind of like show people where I tripped over. And then they wanted more of me. It was quite hilarious at that point of time. But it's nice to think that way and say, you know, I look back and I can laugh at myself. But some of us are not in a space to be able to laugh at ourselves yet. So I wanted to highlight this because I know this is about leadership. This is also about the individual who's attempting to make a transformation. And I realized that both of them meet somewhere. There's a midway point where the person who holds the authority over an individual contributor could be a boss in a company. You might be running an organization. Some of my large organization contributors and clients include like Siemens, right? One of the largest organizations in the world. HSBC, some of the banks out there. But the leader is not just someone who holds a formal authority. The leader is also someone who holds any kind of authority over the individual contributor. So what does that mean? It means that if you, the individual, are not leading yourself, then you're waiting for the circumstances around you to lead you. And unfortunately, that may mean that you're going to go in this kind of a cyclical and maybe even a downward spiral into something that's not you. I mean, I need to allude to this for a little while because there is an absolute amazement of being alive and being well and being around amid an absolutely terrible and terrifying pandemic out there. There's so much division, but yet here we have close to 500,000 people registered on the Embodiment Conference. Now that's got a very big statement that's been made there, that we are in together to fulfill a particular destiny. And like Oprah likes to say, we have a supreme destiny waiting for us and it isn't here yet, right? So we need to learn how to awaken this, awaken the embodiment of shame and to begin to start seeing that it's nothing more than a messenger. It's nothing more than a thing inside of you that's trying to get your attention. And once you know how to get your attention right and focus your attention, laser sharp focus on it, then you'll discover that shame is a part and parcel of a process that literally enlightens and uplifts you. I know it sounds impossible, but trust me, I've studied people who've undergone shame and began to have the courage to speak about it. And these people are not small people. They come from all walks of life. They come from people who are poor. There are people who are professors. There are people who are movie stars, right? Rock stars, literally. And it is because of this small little bit of shame that suppressed their absolute fulfillment of their destiny. So I want you guys to understand that behind, show me anyone who's highly successful and I'll show you a traumatic past, right? So let's quickly get over the definitions of guilt and shame. I mean, there are many academic definitions. I've read almost all of them. But in my opinion, I think guilt elicits reparative behavior. I want to go repair a relationship. I feel guilty, so I take what's within my power to go fix something in that relationship. So if you feel guilty because you forgot your wife's birthday, good luck to you, by the way, then you're going to buy her flowers, hopefully enough flowers and not the ones that she's allergic to. And you're going to buy chocolates and all that kind of stuff. And you're maybe going to attempt to cook her a nice dinner or bring her out to a nice place so that you try and erase that guilt. You know what I'm saying? I know you know what I'm saying because almost everybody goes through something universally like that. You know that you screwed up, you want to make amends. That's what guilt is. And it's within you, and you know that you did something that was wrong, but it's not beyond repair. What seems to be beyond repair is shame. It's self-implosive. It makes you so obvious and so self-conscious that you don't belong to this world. You want to shy away. It's like when you stand up in front of people and say, I don't know how to swim. And everybody glares at you and wonders where you've been, what kind of parents you've had and all that kind of stuff. And unfortunately, even something as simple as that, not knowing how to do something, can be used as a weapon to activate shame in other people. Now, as leaders, there are a lot of things that we have to bear in mind. The first thing is we could say something that shames, right? And it's true as an individual too. You can say something that shames yourself. But the second thing, which I think is far more powerful, is this. Look, I mean, if you go, you guys, go to my YouTube channel. I'm Chinese Singaporean, right? And I've been on YouTube almost from the time YouTube started. And you can imagine seeing the kinds of comments that are out there. I mean, I'm in one sense, I'm glad that I don't have hundreds of millions of subscribers, but just those people who come across my channel, they'll say something that attempts to shame me or embarrass me in front of a global audience. But you've got to recognize that that's uncontrollable. I cannot control what other people say. I can only control how it evokes that shame inside of me and begin to look a little bit deeper. I hope that makes sense. Someone can come up to me and say, you know, in fact, this was a comment in YouTube, something along the lines of, you know, you know, who are you to teach us this, you chink, and, you know, some derogatory terms and stuff like that. So in the lighthearted spirit of the moment, you know, I don't feel like I was discriminated against. I responded by saying, wow, you found a chink in my armor, haha. And as hilarious as that might sound, it won me more followers than less, which was kind of funny because it really depends how you respond to the shaming comment. In organizations, this happens, but it happens probably more often that what somebody receives is the thing that evokes the shame, the meaning that it's attached to it. I mean, somebody can say, oh, you're too young, and suddenly your eyes glare at them as if they said something terribly wrong, and you feel so ashamed that someone's calling you out for your age, and then you get upset, and then you go in and say, he's right, and then you go into this downward spiral. But the same person can be told the same phrase, oh, you're too young, and the person starts beaming and smiling and going like, well, thanks a lot, you know, because that makes them feel good that they're young. It's an interpretation, and it's the meaning that we carry. How we focus on it, however, is crucial. So the leader's input, whether you're the leader of your own life or whether you're a leader of someone else's life or career or whatever, it is your input that hopefully will drive some kind of idea inside other people so that the output is generated as pleasant, positive, effective. We know, however, that the conscious effort of putting leadership input is not very high. In Asia, for example, we experience quite a number of people who are very afraid of giving feedback. And you know what feedback does to most people? They go like, you know, if I give good feedback, I have to back it up by a pay raise, right? If I give a C average rating, then I can just shut up and say like, you know, you're average. There's nothing to say about it. You know, what can you improve on? Okay, this, that, and the other. But if I give a bad rating, right, that's tantamount to shaming, maybe even bullying. And then the leader is in a bad spot. But then again, most of us know how to get out of this, but we don't really have a community to practice this. So what you need to recognize is that the leader's input, and in fact, if we can classify you as the leader of your own life, then this applies to you as well. Your input matters a lot. So why do people feel shame? Why do you feel worthless, helpless, and hopeless? Well, primarily because of this disease of validation. You're asking five primary questions. Do I mean anything, right? Do I mean anything to you, especially in a relationship when someone walks out of the relationship? Did I even mean anything to you? Do you see me, right? Do you see me for who I am, how I'm represented here, and not to turn a blind eye? I mean, the fastest way is to just stonewall someone and pretend that they're not there. Scientific research has shown that when managers at least give feedback, like, you know, there was this experiment where employees were supposed to fill up something as part of a performance, put it into a pile so that the manager, who's actually the psychologist playing the manager, would either take a look at it and acknowledge them or just put it somewhere else and wave them away. And another one that didn't respond at all. The one that responded typically got a higher level of motivation in the people that he was managing. The one that did not respond at all had the worst levels of engagement, disengagement. And that kind of tells us that validation is such a powerful thing. And as I mentioned to you before, me getting good grades was a validation that I was enough, right? That was good. But in school, at least. But then the same grading system doesn't apply when you're in the working world, right? You know, no professor is out there giving you grades. And even if you showed it off, people are going to say that you're arrogant. And then that's the entire conundrum. We've been trained in school to look out for good grades, but in life, nobody really gives you those grades, right? So what's going on there? Does this mean that I'm not enough? Everybody's always asking, is this okay? Is this okay? You know, whenever I interview people, they finish off the interview and then they say, was that okay? They want some kind of validation. Am I enough and do I belong? So with these five questions, we can already imagine the pathway. It's a very circuitous pathway towards doom, literally, right? So think about this. We live in an internet-based culture. You're supposed to share everything. The size of your opt-in list determines the size of your paycheck, you know, that kind of thing. How many likes you have on a particular so-called viral post will determine whether or not you're worth listening to. Really? But just think about that, right? Nowadays, if we take a look at the kind of validation, it's a fake validation. I give you a thumbs up on Insta, on TikTok, on Facebook, and suddenly you feel validated. You want to do more of that. Really? Is that the only place where we can get the right kind of validation? And if you ask me, just because someone decided to unlike you or to unfriend you, surprisingly or not, for some people, it is the end of the world. A little bit more on that later on. So ultimately, these three characteristics point to one inner belief system, which is, I am not safe in this world. I don't feel that I can move forward. I'm going to get bashed. I don't feel that I can do nothing. Therefore, I just stay there like a deer in headlights. And you know, since I can't do anything, I must be bad. And therefore, I'm not safe in this world. How then do we create this kind of safety? If you are going to have to wait for somebody else to create the safety, the unfortunate truth is, and I would say, you know, not intentionally, I would say 8 out of 10 people are just going to make you feel not safe, right? I mean, doesn't matter. You might be standing next to the president of the United States, whomever he or she is, right? You might be standing next to a kindergarten, a preschooler, right? And when you take a look at yourself standing there, you can still feel hopeless, worthless, and helpless, simply because you have built in this internal belief system that has not yet been corrected. Now, again, shame comes from many, many different sources, but we need to begin to explore that. So how in the world do we do that? Well, here are some very simple but tangible things you can do. The first one, as far as I've seen across the board of people who have shame, but they began to become vulnerable to it, is they started to learn to address it. They recovered from it and they addressed it. Now, if you're a leader within an organization, if you see humiliation, not addressing it is basically tolerance of that behavior, right? So, you know, when I'm back in the army, whenever I see humiliation or any form of bullying, I speak up and I don't care who it is. It could be a colonel, it could be a brigadier general. I'll call them out and I'll say, look, that's not what an officer does, or that's not what a senior supervising officer does, right? That's not right. Now, by me doing that, can I change anything? I mean, the next thing you'll know, maybe I get charged for some, you know, insubordination or whatever it is. Although fortunately, that's not happened in my life. And the good news is that, you know, I don't always have to be so confrontational. I can pull a person aside and have a conversation by addressing that. Likewise, I don't just address the perpetrator of that event. I sit down and I address the person who's receiving that to figure out how you're processing that, right? Whether you suddenly feel that your entire identity has been crushed as a result of that singular comment. It's possible. And all I can say is that to a great extent, those of us who've been constantly crushed, constantly stepped upon, constantly sidelined, right? There are only two pathways. Number one, you kind of get used to it and you just do whatever you need to do because you don't get validation from the outside world. Or you become so small and so tight and so tiny and so resentful of what's happened to you in the world that you feel like striking out, but then vicious cycle, right? Second thing you can do is learn how to create space. If you're a leader for your team, create a space by learning to conduct a conversation without judgment. Help the people in your team to gain insight. Now, obviously, if you're doing this for yourself, you might be wondering, so have a conversation with what? You know, my perpetrators, I mean, they're the ones that caused the shame in the first place. And my answer is have a conversation with the inside of you that is hurting. We'll come back to that because that's such a crucial component of embodiment. And then the second part is reflection, right? For people who do journaling, I'm still very surprised a lot of people journal what they've done, right? Like a to-do list, like a massive to-do list. My personal recommendation has always been journal down the decisions you made and why, because that gives you what I call self-improvement analytics, right? Self-improvement analytics. As a result of going back, taking a look at that, you'll be able to say, hey, you know, that's what happened. That's why I made a decision. Maybe some of that decision has to change. And there's an entire chain reaction based on the decisions that we made. So when you create a space, what are you really doing? Well, first of all, let's have a fictitious example, right? So John and Mary having a conversation. Mary suddenly receiving something from John. Ah, this guy is so demanding, right? And then because she receives it this way, John is also getting a certain energy, a vibe from her going, oh, she's just being so stubborn. Why isn't she just listening to me? And guys, you know for a fact that arguments take place not because of big things. I mean, very few people actually have a squabble or an argument because of, you know, the nuclear power plant that's been created next by your neighbor next door, right? Yes, there's some protest, but the truth of the matter is that you don't spark an argument with an individual because you're arguing about big things. Usually you sit down and argue about small things. Why haven't you washed your dishes? You know, why is your underwear still not put in the washer? You know, things like that. So the moment this happens, you feel that there's this line that that's created that fractures the relationship between the two of you. That is the beginning of the end of any kind of a relationship, stonewalling, defending your point of view when you haven't even crossed over to the other side. That, my friends, is the reason why every time you're in an argument, you always think you're right. And it's ironic, but it's true. All of us are in an argument, and sometimes the worst kind of argument is to be in an argument within ourselves. So it's, you know, on one hand, I'm like this, but on the other hand, I'm not like this. And then that's where a lot of that shame, the buildup of very negative emotions actually festers. So let's assume that John and Mary meet up with each other again another day. And John is still chasing Mary for a project, right? Where's the project? And then he's coming from an assumption, she's just incompetent. And she is coming from a position of he's uncaring. But are these actually stated? Are these actually mentioned? And the answer is usually no. And usually what's even more invisible as factors that act on this conversation is what we call the meta cognition or the meta emotion behind all this. So for example, John might be pressured by his own boss that if he doesn't get this done, he's going to get fired or potentially demoted or withheld from some kind of benefit, right? But does he speak this? And the chances are no, right? So on the other hand, what's happening to Mary? Maybe her grandma just passed away and she's having a really difficult time, but she's got this belief system that says, we don't talk about personal things in the office. That's private stuff. You don't have to know about it. But notice what cycle that's causing. And that's going to cause even more of a divide because you're just simply taking a small crack in the wall and you're hammering in pegs, right? So that they split apart. And as a result, no communication. Well, you talk, but communication, real communication isn't there. And as a leader, this is one of the things I've discovered. Everybody's making assumptions about everybody's assumptions. And at the end of the day, what you get is an incorrect, imprecise, ineffective way of getting people to be engaged, loyal, trusting, and build a safe environment. I mean, accusing someone of being incompetent or uncaring, yeah, that's going to be a great way to build psychological safety in a team. Not. The third thing that I always encourage leaders to do is to build for themselves and for other people, if possible, a self-care and mental wellness practice. So, you don't have to open a clinic or anything like that, but I'm pretty sure you guys have heard this already if you've been a part of this conference. Mindfulness, get coaching, improve your levels of education. Why? Because, and I was taken by this particular interview with Jewel. I don't know whether you guys know Jewel, an absolutely awesome singer and musician, multi-platinum best-selling songwriter during the days when I was still going to college, okay? And one of the things that I discovered was that I didn't realize she had a debilitating anxiety issue, right? And she did mention she was kind of listening to mindfulness videos on YouTube, and they keep saying, you know, focus on the moment, focus on the moment. And she's going like, I can't focus on anything. And she found that the only thing that she could focus on was her hand. And I believe this was an interview that was done with Tom Bilyeu on Impact Theory. And Tom is a fantastic interviewer. So what she did was literally just focus on the thing that she could focus on. I know it sounds trite, but have you ever attempted, I mean, if you've never even attempted to focus on one thing in all of your life, then maybe starting out with what can be focused on sounds like a pretty good idea to train up that habit. And you and I both know that habits are the foundation of our character. So she did that, and she reported that after some time, she began to realize that it wasn't just, oh, I see my hand, I see my nails, I see it's of a certain color, and so on and so forth. It began to be like, oh, I can play a musical instrument with this. Wow. Oh, this is the hand that I use to reach out to my fans or to pen a response. And as that happens, you begin to see that there is more to it than a debilitating emotion, whether it's shame, negativity, pain, whatsoever. A lot of that, however, requires consistency. And this is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this talk. And all I can say is that the solutions are actually simple, but the journey, my friends, is not. In the journey of creating a higher level of capacity for yourself, it will totally and adequately eliminate helplessness, because suddenly you feel competent, right? You've got the capacity to do things. But how do you build capacity? So many areas of capacity, cognitive capacity to hold an argument professionally, physical capacity to work out and to have a strong enough body, right? So that you can, you know, weather the storm, so to speak. You don't have to be afraid so much of a viral infection compared with some other people who don't have that, right? So how do we build that capacity? Next one, with capacity, worthlessness can be eroded as well, right? Because with capacity, you're beginning to churn out results. The only difference is whether those results are meaningful or not. And all I can say is that if you haven't got a coach or a mentor, I think it's time for you to actually speak to one, because role model figures of our past will continue to dictate our future direction unless you begin to rearrange your focus towards other people who have been able to produce results that are meaningful to you, that are worthy to you, right? And the last thing is about vision. And you'll realize that vision emerges from the foundations of your capacity. I keep learning new things, put myself into what Carol Dweck calls the growth mindset, and then to establish results utilizing this capacity, not just knowing about it. And then a vision emerges. Huh, I can do this. Yeah. Well, then why don't I do this in a bigger fashion? And you know what I realized about that? I realized that we're literally asking for suffering. The fact that you've got a broader vision, a clearer goal, a bigger thing to aim for is sometimes daunting. Yeah, people get motivated to move towards something they desire, but a lot of the time, they forget that it's not about the vision alone. It is the foundations that forge that vision. And if you can focus on that, the vision that emerges, no matter how difficult and no matter how tough, that's going to be very, very powerful for you. And which is one of the reasons why leaders have got to believe in their employees' capabilities and the ability for them to generate results. They may not say it, but maybe these days it's better to say that. You know, Ravi, I noticed that one of the things that you said at the start of this entire thing was, tell us how you feel, where you're from. Why would anyone want to do that, right? I mean, if you're in a corporation, does your CEO come up to you and say, hey, how are you feeling? What's going on? You know, where are you from? Does a CEO typically do that? And based on my experience, no. They do that sometimes, but not enough to be able to let people feel that there is an authenticity about that, right? And these days when people are melting down, I mean, I've seen news reports, especially in Singapore, people throwing stuff outside their fifth floor window just because they're so frustrated at quarantine and all of that, right? So no wonder the idea of literally just reaching out and with words saying, how are you feeling? What's going on in your life? Where are you from? Allows a person to be seen and to matter. And I applaud that. Thank you very much for that, Ravi, because I think that's really meaningful. And unfortunately, most people don't realize that. So here's the thing. You don't want to lead by a purpose, because most people don't wake up, you know, they don't come out after birth and suddenly go like, huh, mom, I've got my purpose in life. They don't do that, right? They go through it because their character is constantly tested. And that test, those tests that go through, that you go through in life, are not necessarily easy. But once your strengths are aligned with that purpose, then you realize that because your character has been honed, you find that the idea of you being small and having to be hidden away, not to be seen by the world, is absolutely ludicrous. The events that happen to us are nothing short of just facts, right? And you've seen, yes, there have been some tumult due to the pandemic, but take a look at some of the other places that are thriving. Literally, one of my friends who's a regional CEO of a cloud cybersecurity company, he's nudging me in the shoulder and he's saying, you know, Stuart, I don't know about you, but the last 3 months has been awesome. Revenue has been up 300%. And I don't know why some people are just satisfied with 110%. And I'm going like, wow, that's great for you. And here I am looking at my pipeline, 0%, you know? So I can either feel miserable or feel hopeful that there's some place somewhere out there in the world where I do belong. And if you start finding or you start searching for it, you eventually will get there. So can I ask all of you guys to indulge me, right? Let's take a look at this dot, okay? And this dot occupies a certain percentage on the screen, doesn't it? How many percent do you think it occupies of the screen? Well, some people argue 5%. You know, it's a little bit hard to kind of like give an actual number to this, but I would say that it's no more than 10% on the screen. Agree? Now, here's what most people do with events that are unfavorable to them in their lives. They usually do this. They magnify it by going closer to it. And when they go closer to it, that dot, even though it's not any bigger, the fact that you bring it closer to you makes it look like it is bigger. And all of a sudden, how much white is there around? Not very much. And unfortunately, a lot of us tend to play this game inside our heads. And yeah, you might say that it's very clinical, it's too simplistic, but have you considered otherwise? Have you considered that perhaps this is blocking your view of the absolute amazing potential that you've got that you've not been able to tap into? So we'll recenter on the idea of shame, but you see, shame has a function. And it's got a useful function. It's neither good nor bad. I just want you to kind of like think about that for a little while. It's neither good nor bad. It just serves a particular function. Same thing with anger. Same thing with any kind of negative thought, doubt, anxiety. They serve a function. And because we live in a disembodied society, the moment you feel anxious, you've got to take that Xanax or whatever pill that you're taking. Whenever you have that headache and that's kind of like causing your adrenaline and cortisol levels to skyrocket in a workplace, you take a Tylenol, you take a Panadol, right? And you just shove it away. But has it occurred to you that maybe they are emerging for a reason? Okay, and that's what I want to talk about. So all of us currently are in this state, let's say shame. When I first realized that I had been cheated by somebody and that the reason why the person cheated, this was a business setting, right? And the reason why the person cheated was because of what I said. I felt a huge, immense amount of shame because it's like, I didn't even dare to speak to my business partners about this, that, oh, so-and-so did this betrayal and cost us $600,000 because of what I said. It was a very bitter pill to swallow. But the irony is that you know, it's hard for a psychologist to be his own psychologist, right? So I know that I knew it wasn't a really good thing. So I had to kind of like find a way towards a specific outcome, but I was just blocked. That arrow, the process and habit was not there because, you know, how many times do you get cheated of $500,000 and above, right? So back in those days, we've heard of people like Anthony Robbins, right? Motivational gurus. They say, come on, just wake up and go do it. You know, Nike propagates that, just do it. And unfortunately, I've come to realize that motivation is really not the thing. There is a reason why you're not motivated. And that's because when you take this action, there may be more to lose than to gain. And that's why the body is so intelligent, right? The only reason why we are unable to get out of the present state is simply because of a domino effect. And it starts off with this, decision and attention. What was I attending to? I was attending to how stupid I was to trust these guys. I brought them into the fold, treated them like my younger brother and sister, and they had the audacity to do this to me. But they say that it's because of me, it was my fault that they cheated the company. And there was this entire spiral of very negative experiences. And I decided, you cannot imagine how much pain that was, right? Because I taught them everything, almost. I remember one night just curling up into a ball, right, with this absolute, you know, on the bed and this absolute thing in my gut. And I just couldn't get rid of it. And I just bawled my eyes out. To be honest, at that point of time, the window was ajar. And I did have some thoughts about that. The irony is that that was so far away from my sense of identity that I think I preserved myself. I'm supposed to be a speaker, a coach, a life coach, a success coach, and yet I'm hit with this, right? So lo and behold, here I am with my partner. Both of us are hurting. But that night, we were supposed to deliver a success speech to an audience of about 120 people. And here, these two guys who are supposed to be at the top of their game, we had written a book called Master Your Mind, Design Your Destiny. And it was on the top of the charts for many, many years. And then here, yeah, these two guys were supposed to be motivational, inspirational gurus. And we had this like drab look on our faces. And it wasn't pretty. And I remember going through some of the things we wanted to say. And one of the things that we had to say was, the meaning of your communication is the response you get. Fresh out of NLP. That literally hit us. We burst out laughing because you understand the irony of this. We are now in such a bad spot, we have no choice but to eat our own medicine. And I remember it was one of the most difficult things for me to do. We weren't getting the results that we wanted with the audience. I literally shut down my slides and I said, guys, let me tell you a story. And I told them the entire story about how we got ripped off. And we were healing as the audience was learning. And I can tell you this, the amount of embarrassment that I had to actually share that story was greeted with other people coming up to me and saying, Stuart, thank you for that story. It made a big difference to me. And I was floored. I was going like, whoa, okay, that made a difference. Cool, then maybe there's something else that we need to do. I began to explore why our inner thoughts actually affect our state. It's because the decisions that we make reinforce the beliefs that we have about things. And sure, do I have skeletons in my closet? Yeah, but someday, you know, they'll come out. But one of the things that I know is this. I've devised a protocol that helps people. And, you know, if you guys find that this is a little bit of a busy slide, it is. Culminates over the last maybe 10, 15 years of my experience there. So when you guys think about what you want in your life, right? Usually there's a belief that emerges, like I want to become a rock star, I want to become a millionaire. But the belief that emerges is muted. And what you need to do with that belief is ask, how does it feel to have that belief? It feels bad. I feel shame. Okay, good. What's the highest positive intention of that shame? It's to protect me. Okay, why does it want to protect you? Because I don't ever want to be embarrassed ever again. Okay, so if you don't want to be embarrassed, what do you want? I want to succeed. Okay, good. So now instead of focusing on wanting to become a rock star, how about focusing on wanting to be protected? Okay, so you set a goal. I want to be protected. Good. What belief emerges from that? And somewhere along that line, the emergence of that sub-goal is going to make what you want easier to do, more tangible, and more believable. All right? And as this cycle goes through, once you get a feeling that, okay, this is relatively easy to do, you go get it done, you find that that feeling is going to let you do things in a way which is likely to help you to get you to where you wanted to go in the first place, all right? Some people also ask questions like, is forgiveness necessary, and so on and so forth. That's a completely different topic altogether, but what I wanted to offer is this. And again, I know an hour is impossible for me to walk you through all the nuances of this. It has taken me about 10 years to develop this emergent beliefs protocol. But all I want to say is this: if you guys are hurting and you feel that you need to reach out to someone and you would like to explore something like this, you know, hit me up. You know, I build a community that actually helps people to develop themselves professionally. But because I'm also a psychotherapist, at least in this region, I do help people with their emotional issues, you know, and whether rightly or wrongly, free of charge, you know. But again, free of charge does not mean free from responsibility. That means you've also got to do your part in order to push your direction forward. So questions: where does it stay in the body? What does it say? What's its intention? Can you preserve the good things you want that it wants you to do? Can you do it? If not, what comes up? And then you repeat these set of questions again. And those of you who would like to take a quick snapshot of this, by all means, go ahead and do so. All right. But after this, Stuart, you guys can reach out to me. Yeah, let me do a very quick summary of this. So I personally, I would say that there are many things that we can do with shame. But ultimately, I would like to maybe share with you a certain song. And a brief reminder of asking yourself, what's your highest, truest, most valued version of yourself, right? So there's the lyrics of this song, and it's called I Hope You Dance. I hope you can go Google it, but it has got some words of wisdom in that, right? I hope you never lose your sense of wonder, get your fill to eat, but always keep the hunger. May you never take one single breath for granted, and God forbid love ever leave you empty-handed. So as you go through this, please don't let some hell-bent heart leave you bitter. When you come close to selling out on yourself, reconsider and give the vision of the heavens more than just a passing glance. And when you get a choice to sit it out or dance, I hope you dance. Over to you, Ravi.
Oh, beautiful. Wow. Thank you, Stuart. We talked a bit in the very beginning when we were just getting to know each other about this idea of authenticity. And really bringing authenticity. And I feel wholeheartedly that you modeled and you led authentically today. So
thank you.
Thank you for that. We've got one question that will just, if you could provide a short-ish answer. We got one question from Richard. He said, I'm trying to find a job. Should I exaggerate my capabilities? I'm afraid I may be held accountable if I stretch the truth, yet I feel I will not be hired if I don't. I think we all can resonate with that as we're in the job search, and I'd love your opinion on that.
I think it's not a good space to be in where we say that, I'll need to exaggerate or I need to lie. But I think it's necessary for us to say that, look, I do have some capabilities and I do have some ability to produce results. And with the capabilities and the results that I have produced, who is most likely to appreciate that value? And sometimes we haven't broadened the search enough. Sometimes we're just looking very narrowly. So this reminds me of a story that was told by a friend of mine. I don't know whether you guys know the fruit called durian. Okay, it's a spiky fruit. It's known as the king of the fruits. And it has this particular odor or a smell, right? Most people in China and most parts of the Straits over here in Southeast Asia, they love durian because it's rich and it's basically a superfood. But the trouble is that if you try to export this, and there was a story where somebody tried to mail a 500-gram durian through the German Postal Service, and 14 people basically got hospitalized as a result of the smell. It was that powerful. But here you've got China buying within the span of one day over $50 or $80 million worth of durian because they just absolutely love that. So my question is, when you talk about value that you provide, who are you providing value to? If you're providing value to somebody who appreciates that value and can see your value, then that's probably the place you want to expand your efforts, right? But then if you haven't searched for who can appreciate this value or how to articulate this value, maybe it's time for you to look into that first before saying that I've got to exaggerate it. Maybe you don't have to. Maybe it's a mistaken belief. But as far as I'm concerned, that belief could be a cycle that's a greater pattern that says that, okay, I just need to show up and I need to, you know, puff myself up just so that I can be better or bigger. I don't think so. And I think if you have to keep doing this, the energy that you have to exude all the time is probably going to damage you more so. And you're going to get, you know, you're going to be flat out, you know, burnt out. So look back into yourself and ask yourself, okay, honestly, do I not have the capability? If I don't, perhaps it's time for me to just re-explore my entire life. Appreciate this question that's about how to find one's own value, which is a lot of the time hunting for the things that mattered to somebody else. One of the fastest ways I found to be able to find your own value is to take a look at a version of yourself that you could help from the past. Meaning to say, those people that you could help best are those who were like you in the past. So, you know, I struggled with academia. My first call to fame was I taught people how to accelerate their learning and to do well in examinations because I could help the previous versions of myself, right? What is a previous version of yourself that if you were to write a letter to, you could give really good advice? And that's probably where you ought to start. I know it sounds a little bit simplistic, but something that you could lean yourself into and find a way to step up because you're the older brother or sister to that younger version of you.
Awesome. So we have time for, literally, you need to answer this in 5 words or less. Sonia asks, what is this beautiful pendant you wear, please?
It's called Libyan Desert Glass, 27 million year old meteorite that streaked the desert, the Sahara Desert. And it's a reminder of energy for me. It also looks like an inverted cross. So I actually have a name for this pendant. It's called Peter, because Peter hung himself upside down on the cross because he didn't want to be crucified the same way as Christ did. In respect for Christ, of course. But this is just a symbol for me of energy, the power of the universe that's in our hands. We've got blood. Blood has got iron inside our cells, in our blood cells. Iron can only be created from the explosion of a star. Just think about that for a moment. We're all made from exploding stars, guys. So if you guys need more info, you know, come to my group. I've got a Facebook community. It's free. You know, I talk to people all the time, share ideas, get others to share ideas as well. So you're absolutely welcome to continue this conversation with me because I know we're on a timer.
And again, you brought the energy, you brought the enthusiasm. Happy birthday again.
Thank you.
glad you chose to celebrate with us all. For those who are still tuning in, there are more sessions on the Leadership and Business channel. There's another one coming up, the Transformation of Leaders Through Bodywork. Stuart, you're a wealth of information. To the folks listening in, if you want to get access to the recordings and the recordings of thousands of talks throughout this conference, they can be yours for a quite low price and delivering so much value. It supports the team that is putting this on. And again, it will support your journey into authentically showing up for your lives, your work, your family, your community, and this universe, as Stuart so eloquently put. Stuart, back to you for one final, in a couple sentences. What is your final piece of wisdom around embodiment and your topic today?
The body is made up of trillions of cells. Some are viruses, some are bacteria. I've also recently got to know the idea of the gut microbiome comes from the earth. You breathe it in. In my opinion, I think it is foolish to think that we're just one entity of logic. I think a lot of it comes from the internal, inside-out approach to becoming a more self-aware individual. It's almost like multiple villages trying to come together to build a person. So there's nothing more sad than to just make a judgment about what we think is right. Like, I should lower my standards, or no, I should stop hoping for so much. Let's get down to the real intention that our body is showing up these emotions. Let's think about what's its highest positive intention so that we can also realize that there are nothing more than messengers for us to become our highest and truest version of ourselves.
I love that. I think that's such a powerful message to leave us with. I want to give another shout out to Tundi, who's been on the background making sure all of our tech works. And she's provided a number of links in the chat. So there's ways to engage with the Leadership and Business Facebook group. There's a coffee break if you want to continue the conversations with other participants. Stuart's Facebook page is also linked, as well as a link to his book and his website. Again, so many ways to keep getting this enthusiasm and energy. You can copy and paste the chat to save it for your own keeping, or you can even hit the save chat function right here in Zoom. So there should be three little dots next to your chat box. But again, thank you to everybody who tuned in from around the world. Thank you, Stuart, for your wisdom and your enthusiasm. And I hope everyone has an embodied, uplifting rest of your week. Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody. And I wish all of you the very best. Have a wonderful rest of the week and the rest of your life too. Bye-bye.